As states around the country start to open back up, many of us are still trying to keep our social distance. But for the millions of Americans in jails and prisons, that's practically impossible. On this show, we've been covering conditions inside jails and prisons around the country, before COVID-19 and now. Months into the pandemic, the number of positive cases and the number of deaths is continuing to rise in these facilities. Just last week, the Bureau of Prisons reported that over 70% of federal prisoners tested were positive for COVID-19. And those are only the people who were tested, which means there could be many more that have the virus. Local law enforcement has been more cautious about introducing new people into jails. But in jail complexes like Rikers Island in New York, so far 3 inmates and 9 staff members have died of the disease. A directive from Attorney General Bill Barr to begin releasing federal prisoners has only caused confusion about the problem and how to address it to keep inmates and staff safe. Today on The Takeaway, we go to Florida and Texas to see how the pandemic is playing out in jails and prisons in those states, as well as in federal prisons around the country. I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. We have 2 guests with us that have been following this closely. Danny Rivero is a reporter and producer for WLRN Public Radio in Florida, and Carrie Blakinger is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Hi, Danny. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Shamita.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course, thanks for being here. Danny, I want to start with you. Can you walk us through the different conditions in facilities in the Miami-Dade area? What are you seeing so far?
Right. So here in Miami-Dade County in the state of Florida, we have the biggest local county jail population. On a normal day, there's about 4,000 inmates. And, you know, that number has come down a little bit because the officials have been taking some steps to kind of draw down the population in the local jails. But as of today, we have over 300 inmates in these facilities that have tested positive for COVID-19. And there's one facility in particular, the Metro West Jail, that has just over 160 inmates. And that facility is now part of a federal lawsuit where a federal judge has now mandated the county to provide all sorts of sanitary equipment and whatnot for inmates in that facility. And just over the weekend, we learned that the first inmate in the jail system here has died, and we're waiting on the medical examiner to confirm that it was COVID that caused the matter of the death. But we know that the inmate had tested positive for COVID-19.
And Carrie, you've been reporting on federal prisons. How has the spread of COVID-19 unfolded in federal facilities?
Federal facilities, like a lot of other places, have been facing a lot of criticism for sort of handling it belatedly or not taking it seriously soon enough. And as of now, there's 1,900 federal inmates who are testing positive for COVID, and there's been 38 deaths. They're not reporting any staff member deaths, which is baffling, because it seems that, you know, there has been local reporting indicating that there have been staff member deaths. But, you know, regardless, it's clearly still something that's ongoing. And I think we have a long ways to go in some of these prisons, especially the larger systems like the federal system and, you know, where I live here in Texas.
Right. And you've done a lot of reporting work there in Texas. Do prisons and facilities there have enough supplies? Do they have what they need to fight the spread of the virus?
I think it depends who you ask.
Yeah, what do you mean?
I mean that, you know, prison officials told me that they've had N95 masks around, you know, that they had, I think, 100,000 of them since the beginning of the year. But on the ground, you know, when I'm actually talking to officers, they're telling me that it's really inconsistent. Some units now have them, but people who are doing hospital transports don't consistently have the PPE they need. I talked to one person who, an officer who had done a transport with someone who confirmed positive and was in the hospital, and they had this officer had a face shield to share with her partner. You know, two officers, one face shield, one coughing infected prisoner. And this is sort of, to me, one of the more egregious examples, but I've heard a lot of things like this. So it seems that even if they do have the equipment, there seems to be some issue with actually getting it out to where it's needed.
Danny, again, you're in Florida. Can you give us a picture of what prisons look like outside of the Miami-Dade area? What do we know about the severity of this problem statewide?
Florida has the third largest prison system, the state prison system in the country. And so far we have 7 reported deaths that have happened in Florida prisons with inmates that have contracted COVID-19. There's almost 400 prisoners that have tested positive for it, and almost 200 staff that have tested positive for it. You know, a lot of the issues that are happening here in Florida tend to be happening inside of private prisons. The first 2 deaths that happened here was up in the panhandle, you know, not far from Alabama. And that was in a facility that was run by Geo Group, a very large private prison contractor. And there was a special amount of controversy in that case because the deaths of the inmates were not made public for almost a week afterwards. And it was only after some reporters started poking around, they actually got that information from the medical examiner's office in that county, that the public learned about it. But we do have, as of now, from what's been made public, 7 deaths that have happened, which is pretty high, actually, for a state prison system. You know, a place like California, I believe, has only had 1 death in their prison system. So it does seem to be spreading rather quickly here in Florida.
Now, in April, Attorney General Bill Barr sent a letter to officials running federal prisons, ordering them to maximize the release of the most medically vulnerable prisoners to home confinement to try and prevent the spread of the virus. Carrie, what has happened in the weeks since the Attorney General gave that directive?
So there's been a lot of back and forth on this and a lot of confusion over what exactly that means and who exactly is eligible. And one of the sort of big points of that has been contentious has been whether or not you need to have served 50% of your sentence, because the guidance has changed on that and BOP's interpretation of the guidance has changed on that. So I'm talking to a lot of families and a lot of prisoners who were told that they would be able to go home. In some cases, signed release papers. In some cases, were sent to 14-day quarantine because they're doing a 14-day quarantine before release, and then taken out of quarantine and told, actually, never mind. And they hadn't served enough of their sentence was the issue here.
Danny, are we seeing a difference in the way that jails and prisons are handling the crisis?
The short answer is yes. You know, the majority of people that are sitting in county jails across the country have not actually been convicted of any crime. These are decisions that are largely made on the front end of a criminal case. And so what we've seen happening here in Florida is a lot of, basically, there's an agreement with the Sheriff's Association, and this has trickled down to virtually every county that I've been able to look at, where sheriff's offices, police departments are making fewer arrests. And the reason for that is that they are trying to bring fewer people into the jail systems in the first place. The fear is that someone that you might bring into the jail one day might have COVID-19, and then that would further spread inside the system. So police have been, you know, issuing civil citations, giving promises to appear, and kind of tackling it from the front end, because they have that authority to make that kind of determination on the front end of a sentence. In a prison, it's a little bit more complicated because the person who's in there has already been sentenced to something, and then that just changes the calculation a little bit.
So, Carrie, what do we know about the number of people who have actually been released from federal prisons to home confinement?
So as of when we looked at this a little bit over a week ago for the Marshall Project, there were only about 1,000 people who'd been sent home under the new guidance, which is half of 1% of the federal prison population. So it's really a drop in the bucket.
I understand that there have been multiple lawsuits around the country by people who are incarcerated. Can you tell us about some of those lawsuits, if any have stood out to you?
Yeah, there have been a number of them. One of the ones that sort of most recently had an update was on Friday, Texas death row prisoners filed a lawsuit, and they also filed to intervene in an existing lawsuit from other Texas prisoners. But I mean, it was striking to me that even in solitary confinement on death row, they feel that the prison system can't adequately take care of them. That alone is pretty stark. And you know, some of the things they're asking for are so basic. They're asking for consistent access to running water and soap. They're not asking to get out. They're not asking to get off of death row. They're just asking to be cared for better. And one of the things they bring up in their lawsuit, which I think hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is that you also have an extremely high needs population in some parts of prison systems, like severely delusional, mentally ill. We have people that hallucinate demons and snakes who are generally kept in solitary confinement. It's not clear that they can understand what a pandemic is or how they're supposed to protect themselves, setting aside the fact that the officers may or may not tell them, because going around and telling individual, you know, cells on death row how to protect yourself from a pandemic is, you know, probably not a priority for them. And even if you do, some of them are extremely mentally impaired. So, I mean, there are some serious concerns that that lawsuit raises.
Danny, what are you expecting to see in the weeks and months to come in facilities in Florida?
The numbers don't look good for the state prison system. They've gone up pretty considerably. And just over the last week in the local jails here in Miami-Dade County, they've almost doubled. So, you know, it's just it's the nature of confinement and of being trapped within four walls. You know, the ability to social distance is very limited. There's thousands of inmates across the state that are currently in medical quarantine. And the state government's issued a lot of statements about it, saying they're tackling it and whatnot. But aside from mass releases, which there doesn't seem to be an appetite for, it's pretty clear at this point that there is going to continue to be spread within different kinds of facilities at local and state level. And it's a little bit of fingers crossed is honestly part of my assessment.
Carrie, reporting on conditions in jails and prisons is never particularly easy. I can imagine it might be even more difficult during a pandemic. Over the course of your reporting, how have you managed to find information about what's actually happening inside?
Well, I mean, I've had a lot of families that reach out to me, but it's also interesting that I think that some prisons, because they're not interested in doing cell searches as much right now, have more access to contraband phones. And I think this is true across many different prison systems. I also think that people are a little more desperate and a little more willing to reach out to reporters, whether that's through traditional means of, you know, written letters, or some cases, like it's pretty easy to get calls from federal prison if they have access to the legitimate phone system. So I think that in some cases, people are more likely to reach out right now because they're so desperate. You know, normally the fear of retaliation and the concerns about talking to the media can be a stumbling block for some people in terms of not wanting to reach out. But right now, things are so dire that I'm hearing a lot more. I mean, it's just been a constant fire hose of tragedy, basically.
Danny Rivero is a reporter and producer for WLRN Public Radio in Florida. And Carrie Blakinger is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Danny, Carrie, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.